Welcome to SNC's podcast series, SNC Critical Insights. I'm Andrew DeFilippis. I am a special counsel in SNC's litigation group and national security practice. I came back to SNC about a year and a half ago after spending 9 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and I previously worked as counselor to the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. Let me first just introduce our panelists today, all of whom are members of our new national security practice. Sharon Cohen-Levin is a leading expert on anti-money laundering, Bank Secrecy Act, and forfeiture matters, and she's co-head of our national security practice. She previously led the money laundering and asset forfeiture unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York for 20 years. Craig Jones is based in London. He is co-head also of the firm's national security practice and a partner in its general practice group. Craig advises clients on European GDPR regulations, anti-money laundering laws, bribery laws, and other financial crime matters. He is admitted to practice both in New York and in England and Wales. Next, we have Eric Cadell, who's co-head of the firm's foreign investment and trade regulation group and its economic sanctions and financial crime group. Eric is an expert and distinguished practitioner in the areas of sanctions, export controls, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. He has been an SNC partner for more than 15 years and previously clerked for the U.S. Supreme Court. Finally, Adam Zubin is of counsel and a member of the firm's financial services group and its national security practice. Adam has a distinguished career in the national security area. Before coming to SNC, he served for nearly 13 years at the Treasury Department, including as director of OFAC and as acting undersecretary for terrorism and financial intelligence. Today, we're going to cover a recent White House executive order and an accompanying Department of Justice advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which addresses the topic of data privacy in the national security context and has the potential to bring about a sweeping new regulatory regime applicable to a broad range of companies and financial institutions. I think we're all aware that recent publicity about various data breaches, the roles of foreign companies like TikTok in the U.S. economy, all reflect an increasing unease about the exploitation of U.S. persons' sensitive data by national security threat countries. This executive order and the planned DOJ rulemaking seem directed at that very issue. Before we get into the specifics of this executive order and the regulation, I just note that unlike the European Union, the U.S. does not have a comprehensive data privacy regulatory framework along the lines of the GDPR. Craig, you're an expert in the GDPR. You've advised clients on how it applies for quite a while now. To what degree, if at all, are these proposed regulations essentially a new U.S. GDPR framework?
Thanks, Andrew. The pending U.S. regulations are far from being a U.S. GDPR. I mean, rather, they address specific national security and privacy threats from five identified countries, China, Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and North Korea, whose governments have a history of collecting sensitive information to harm the security interests of the United States. I mean, some key differences from GDPR include that GDPR essentially aims to give individuals rights in relation to their personal data, whilst the pending regulations address national security concerns. Then GDPR regulates all types of data processing, including the transfer of personal data outside of the EU, whereas these pending regulations essentially focus only on data transfers and to the targeted countries. And finally, GDPR applies to all personal data, with some more restrictive provisions applicable to certain categories of more sensitive data, whilst these new regulations would apply to a narrower set of data, as we'll come on to discuss. But having said that, the new regime will have potentially major effects on a wide range of private companies, because it is private actors who will be required under the regulations to monitor and restrict the flow of US persons' data to the affected countries.
This framework is expressly based on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or commonly referred to as IEEPA, and it adopts an economic sanctions type model of implementation. There are contemplated exemptions to the rules, licenses, re-export provisions, designation authority, all terms that we're familiar with in the OFAC sanctions context. Eric, what does that tell us about how expansive a regulatory regime this will be?
Thanks, Andrew. Look, I think there's a couple points to make here. You know, first of all, at this stage, we have an executive order and an advance notice of proposed rulemaking that fleshes out a framework for how the Justice Department and the other interagency collaborators are thinking about how a regime like this would work, but we don't even have proposed rules yet. So all of what we're saying today is a little bit preliminary. That said, I do agree with your point. There are absolutely some elements of this program that appear to be drawn from the Treasury Department Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, sanctions regime and the Commerce Department export control regime. I think, interestingly, at least in terms of a historical approach to these kinds of issues, many of these problems were handled through CFIUS. But CFIUS only applies to foreign investment in the United States. Some people might question, well, why is the Justice Department running a program that looks like Treasury or Commerce might be more familiar with, or at least better positioned to administer, given the history that they've had in administering regimes that appear to be relatively comparable? But I think the fundamental point is that the Justice Department, through the CFIUS process, has typically been the lead agency in protecting the access to personal data by threatening foreign actors. And I think it's because of that substantive expertise that the DOJ is going to administer this program. But we'll have to keep a close eye on exactly how it gets fleshed out as we see first a proposed rule and then ultimately final rules.
And Sharon, I wanted to get your further thoughts on that last point about the DOJ. What should we take from the fact that this executive order does make the DOJ the primary agency responsible for implementing the regulations? And do you think the DOJ will need to set up a sub-agency in order to administer these rules?
Well, it is somewhat unusual for DOJ to be delegated an entirely new regulatory regime like this. We generally think of DOJ as a law enforcement agency, as opposed to an administrative agency or a rulemaking body. Of course, there are other areas where DOJ has promulgated regulations, such as ATF's regulation of firearms, but those regulations seem much more closely related to the traditional law enforcement mission. Another area with DOJ rulemaking authority is the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's not unprecedented for DOJ to administer regulations, but it's not necessarily what we are most accustomed to seeing DOJ do. As for whether it will require DOJ to establish an agency, well, it'll clearly require additional personnel and resources. The implementation of DOJ's designation and licensing authorities is going to require a staff that is well acquainted with these issues and familiar with the regulations. And on that front, it does seem like establishing at least a new component or office within DOJ would make sense.
Turning now to the specific definitions that are laid out in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, it defines three concepts, among others: covered persons, covered data, and covered transactions. And those terms sort of define the ambit of what the regulations will regulate. So let's talk about each of those, starting with covered persons. the way that the currently contemplated version of the regulations defines that term is, among other things, any entity that is 50% or more owned directly or indirectly by a country of concern, or that is organized or chartered under the laws of, or has its principal place of business in a country of concern, even if the company is private. Turning to you, Adam, and recognizing that's just a portion of the definition, how does this concept mirror or differ from OFAC's regulations, which address ownership or control by a sanctioned entity?
Well, you can hear, just as you're reciting the sort of proposed approach, certain similarities to OFAC's approach. And the 50% or more threshold is one that OFAC has had for 10 plus years now when it comes to companies that are 50% or more owned by designated persons. On the other hand, there's already differences in terms of here it's ownership by a country of concern, and there's also reference to where the company is organized or chartered or has its principal place of business. And some of those are really departures from the OFAC approach. I think the bottom line, I would say, is two things. One, we still need to know more about how DOJ is going to flesh out these definitions and apply them to examples. They've given us some guidance, but I think there's probably more to come. And second, this is absolutely going to require similar compliance efforts, including careful KYC, knowing your customer, to what we've seen in the sanctions and money laundering arenas, in order to determine foreign ownership and who is the ultimate beneficial owner. Like in those arenas, there's also going to be, no doubt, attempts by actors from the covered countries to try to mask their ownership and devise schemes to circumvent these rules. So we've seen in the past countries like the UAE have been hotspots for schemes to evade Iran sanctions. Sometimes UAE citizens would nominally own 51% of a company, but the company in fact was Iranian run and controlled, which allowed for them to transship goods coming from the United States. And I'm sure we'll see similar efforts at evasion here by the countries of concern. But the regulations, as currently contemplated, anticipate that. They look to substance over the form, and they cite factors like a company's principal place of business and really try to determine whether a company is controlled by a threat nation.
And to that point, Eric, on the last part, Adam was discussing about these sorts of determinations under the regulations. Is this going to require extensive due diligence on counterparties by financial institutions, companies? And to what extent will that process resemble the current CFIUS process?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the way I'm looking at this is it's a little bit of a complement to another initiative from the Biden administration that's still pending with the Treasury Department following an advance notice of proposed rulemaking and yet to see the actual proposed rules. But that was the Executive Order 14-105 that was issued last summer to establish new restrictions on outbound investment from the United States in China specifically in that case. And people sometimes refer to this as reverse CFIUS or outbound investment restrictions. This is kind of similar in that it's not necessarily going to be a situation where the Department of Justice is reviewing transactions case by case. They're going to put the compliance burden on parties that are engaged in the relevant transactions. You might think of it as ease the burden to some degree by allowing a process for obtaining advisory rulings and licensing of transactions that are brought to its attention by a party in seeking to comply. But one area where I think there will be quite a lot of impetus for due diligence, and I think Sharon touched on this earlier, is in the KYC and knowing what party you're dealing with and whether that party, in fact, is going to be a covered person for purposes of these regulations. And that might be obscured through chain of ownership or beneficial ownership devices that are designed to obscure true ownership and things of that nature.
Another concept under the regulations is covered data. It doesn't address every kind of data, but it specifies what covered data is. And in particular, the advance notice contemplates that data sets exceeding specific thresholds would be considered, quote, high risk of exploitation by a country of concern. So, for example, the notice lays out that covered personal identifiers, personal health data, or personal financial data of more than 1 million U.S. persons, biometric identifiers or geolocation data of more than 10,000 U.S. persons, or genomic data of more than 1,000 persons would trigger the high-risk designation and the regulations. Eric, what do you make of those thresholds, recognizing that they're preliminary, and are those numbers too low or too high in your view?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I mean, look, I think there's a sort of a mirroring effect here where the CFIUS regulations, as they define sensitive personal data for purposes of foreign investment in the United States, also have thresholds like this, where for it to be a particularly sensitive data transaction, there needs to be records that are tied to a particular individual above a threshold. And I think that they're trying to do something similar here. They're not maybe cutting it exactly the same, but there's clearly some effort to focus on targets that are the highest threat or businesses that are the highest threat to national security in their transacting in this sensitive personal data. If you happen to be a company that has, you know, one or two records, then it may be that the cost of imposing a system like this on your transactions is just deemed to be too high and capturing too many businesses. I think we'll see how this plays out. I mean, it's clearly something that will be the subject of comments as people look at the advance notice of proposed rulemaking and eventually at the proposed rules. It's worth noting, it currently as proposed, the thresholds would not apply to data transactions that involve government-related data, which would be inclusive of sensitive personal data that a transacting party markets as being linked or linkable to current or recent former employees, contractors, senior officials of the U.S. government, including the military and intelligence community, and then also precise geolocation data for any location within an area enumerated on particular lists that are close to government facilities, essentially. So there is a level of heightened sensitivity for government-related data, at least as conceptualized in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. So it will be interesting to see where this ends up in final form.
And then the final concept that we wanted to describe today is covered transactions. The contemplated regulations would only apply to covered data transactions, which DOJ currently anticipates would include four categories: data brokerage transactions, vendor agreements, employment agreements, and investment agreements. Now, the notice further breaks down those categories or separates those categories between prohibited transactions and restricted transactions. Prohibited transactions are those that the regulations will prohibit outright. Restricted ones are transactions that will be subject to security requirements approved by the Department of Homeland Security. In the prohibited category, the current contemplated regulations would put data brokerage transactions or human genomic transactions involving bulk genomic data. In the restricted category are vendor agreements, employment agreements, and investment agreements. Craig, what did these contemplated definitions tell us about how broad or how narrow a framework this is going to be?
It's a further example, really, of how different from a much narrower framework than the GDPR we're dealing with. By proposing to define the covered transactions in this way, the DOJ is limiting the framework's effect to a very specific type of transactional agreement. And as we discussed earlier, it contrasts with GDPR, which applies very broadly, including to routine processing activities, such as sharing basic identifying information from company emails with external parties just in the course of day-to-day business, or in connection with litigation, regulatory investigations, those sorts of things. I guess it's not surprising the government is focused specifically on data brokers, because those are the companies who currently sell vast amounts of US persons' data, largely without restrictions or regulation at the moment. The fact that certain data brokerage transactions involving these countries will be prohibited, whereas the vendor agreements, employment agreements, and investment agreements are merely restricted, i.e. subject to security requirements, just highlights the DOJ's particular concern with the national security and data privacy risks that are posed by these data brokers.
The executive order and the DOJ document both say that they don't currently intend for covered transactions to encompass those that are merely incident to everyday financial transactions or to the purchase of commercial goods. How should those concepts and terms be defined? And is it inevitable that that kind of activity will be affected by regulations, possibly in unforeseen ways? And Adam, curious if you have thoughts based on your OFAC background.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you ask, is it inevitable that the regulations will have unintended effects? The answer is probably yes. The US government is clearly trying to signal that they are not imposing a blanket ban on information flows to the relevant countries that would accompany ordinary everyday purchases of goods or financial services. But it's going to require some further definitional work. If you suppose, for example, that a US-based company that does marketing for a China-based manufacturer collects and sends to another Chinese company large quantities of US persons' personal and financial data that those persons shared when purchasing goods from the first Chinese company online, it's an interesting question to ask, is that incidental to the purchase or no? The recipient Chinese company was not involved in the purchase, but the data was generated through a purchase. So these and many other questions are no doubt going to be coming before DOJ, and the devil will be in the details as to how they craft these exceptions.
Greg, what type of companies, in your view, are most likely to be affected here?
Well, given the focus on big data and data brokers, I mean, one type of company that is likely to have to grapple with these regulations is credit reporting companies. Companies like Experian, for example. They engage in traditional credit reporting, but they also aggregate and sell all kinds of data. And it's companies like that that are going to have to carefully examine their potential touch points with the affected countries.
Sharon, the executive order makes clear that the DOJ will have not only civil authority, but criminal authority to enforce these data privacy regulations. Is that surprising to you?
No, not really. Although the order delegates both civil and criminal authority to the DOJ, it's not clear whether the DOJ intends to pursue criminal enforcement actions, or at least as an initial matter. The issue of data privacy has typically been viewed in the US as more of a civil than a criminal issue. That said, these regulations are promulgated under IEPA, which contains provisions that make it a crime to intentionally violate or evade regulations implemented under the statute. So once the DOJ regulations are in effect, there's no reason prosecutors cannot bring a criminal prosecution against those who intentionally violate them. It's not surprising that the executive order sought to preserve and delegate criminal enforcement authority to DOJ. While we don't usually think of commercial data privacy breaches as crimes in and of themselves, these forthcoming regulations involve issues of national security. That is an area in which the U.S. government always seeks to maximize its available enforcement tools. And data privacy issues are also similar and, frankly, closely related to issues of cybersecurity breaches and hacks, which, of course, we've seen DOJ tackle with criminal prosecutions.
And Sharon, to come back to you again, how should banks and companies think about incorporating this framework into their decision-making, compliance programs, Are these rules likely to become a major new area of criminal and regulatory enforcement?
Well, the DOJ said in the advance notice that they intend to assess and impose penalties for corporate violations of these regulations based in part on the strength of a company's compliance program. Therefore, companies absolutely should plan to make these regulations a part of their compliance programs and employee training. We've already seen in the sanctions area, banks and money service businesses consider OFAC compliance to be part of their overall Bank Secrecy Act AML compliance obligations. And certain state regulators, such as the New York State Department of Financial Services, incorporate OFAC requirements into its regulated entities' compliance requirements. These data privacy regulations are promulgated under EPA, the same authorizing statute as the OFAC rules. So we may expect to see a similar approach, but it's important to note that data transfers are different from the exportation of goods and financial services, because the details of particular sensitive bulk data flows or transactions will not generally be available to a bank that merely holds accounts or clears transactions for a customer. As a result, banks cannot monitor for suspicious or illegal activity in the same way. That said, banks themselves will need to think carefully about agreements they enter with data brokers and other companies that may be subject to these regulations. And relatedly, once DOJ has designated an entity or an individual pursuant to these regulations, financial institutions will also have to consider whether and how that might affect whether they're willing to provide financial services to such parties as customers, and could also affect decisions to whether or not to file suspicious activity reports on any transactions that they identify.
And finally, Craig, what do you think we can expect in terms of whether these regulations trigger further consideration and debate in the United States of moving closer to a GDPR style framework? And what sorts of things should people keep in mind as they have those discussions?
I think regulatory creep is a fact of life these days. And because the DOJ is going to have new regulatory authorities once this is implemented, it's inevitable that there will be some sort of consideration of expanding those authorities. Not directly related to GDPR-style provisions, but already we've seen Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon make a number of statements and legislative proposals concerning the purchase and sale of U.S. persons' geolocation data and other personal information, including actually by U.S. intelligence agencies. And those types of discussions and proposals are likely to continue. In looking more generally, whether expansion of the provisions in a sort of GDPR-style way would be a positive thing, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's already a move at state level to introduce GDPR style rules. So we have the CCPA, for example, and equivalent legislation in other states. And yeah, a US GDPR might in some ways be more appealing than a patchwork of different regimes.
Thanks very much, Craig. And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you to our panelists. I'm sure everyone at Sullivan & Cromwell will be keeping a close eye on these pending regulations. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on our website at www.sulcrom.com.